We are literally in a genomics revolution. We are learning so much more about disease and, you know, using genomics to understand more.
So the colour of your eyes, whether you are short or tall, perhaps even a cheeky dimple when you smile, these are all the things we often attribute to family genetics. But what if you inherited something much more serious? Well, at just 29 years of age, Sarah Powell was diagnosed with breast cancer. And during this experience, she discovered she carried a gene mutation, putting her at a higher risk of cancer. A gene mutation that may have been passed on to her own children. Drawing on her own unique experience, Sarah is now the CEO of Pink Hope. And their aim is for people to understand and reduce their risk of hereditary cancer. And to mark Breast Cancer Awareness Month, Sarah joins us today to share her incredible personal story, a story of courage and resilience and, of course, hope, or should we say, pink hope. So, Sarah, thank you so much for joining us today and agreeing to share such a personal story with us. I'd love to start at the beginning of your breast cancer journey and understand, you know, how you dealt with this. I mean, you were only 29 at the time, very young. So how did this all come about?
Yeah, well, thank you for having me today. So I was 29 years old, like you said, and I was not checking my breasts. And, you know, most people under 30 aren't checking their breasts. I was very lucky that my tumour was sort of right under my armpit almost, really kind of around the side of my breast. And so when I was washing in the shower, you know, washing under your arms, I was like, oh, there's a little lump there. And I was actually in Thailand at the time. And my husband said, don't be silly, you know, you're 29, what can it be? So when I got back from Thailand, I went to see the GP and she asked me if I had a family history of breast or ovarian cancer, which I don't. And she said, look, you're young, I'm sure it's nothing, but let's go and do an ultrasound. We did the ultrasound. And while they were doing the ultrasound, the sonographer said to me, have you been sick recently? And I said, no. And he said, oh, I can see quite a few enlarged lymph nodes in your breast. Definitely go back to your GP. So I went back to the GP and she said, oh, they want you to go and get a biopsy. So, you know, this all takes a few weeks. And so I went to a breast clinic and they did the biopsy. And the lady that did the biopsy, the doctor, she said to me, make an appointment from tomorrow, hey? So I was like, okay. And so I came back the next day. My husband didn't even come with me because he was so convinced that, of course, it's nothing. So I sat in a chair and they said, yeah, well, sorry, it's breast cancer. And the doctor that did the biopsy, she actually said to me, because when I had my surgery, she said, oh, I knew it was cancer. She said, sometimes you just know. She said, obviously, I couldn't say that to you, but she said, I was pretty convinced. That's why I was like, you need to come back tomorrow. So that started my whirlwind journey of breast cancer. I was pretty fortunate at the time because the tumor was caught really early. It was about 1.2 centimeters, so very small. So at the time, I just needed a lumpectomy. I went on to have chemotherapy and radiation. Before I started any treatment, they were worried about my fertility and how chemotherapy might affect that. So they suggested that I go to an IVF clinic and sort of talk about, you know, trying to preserve my fertility. Unfortunately, because I had a very aggressive type of cancer, so when they did the surgery, the cancer had already started to move into the lymph nodes, which is what the sonographer could see. Yes, yeah. So my oncologist said, look, I'll let you do some IVF, but you've got 4 weeks, that's it. So we had to do this one round of IVF, and those who've been through IVF sort of know that the first time you do it, they kind of pitch the drugs they give you at a, you know, kind of average level. For some people it's not enough, some people it's too much, but they don't want to over, you can hyperstimulate and create too many eggs, and that's quite dangerous. Unfortunately for me, that, you know, it just wasn't enough. So I think I ended up with about 5 embryos from that, which was, you know, it was better than nothing, and off we went. So I had my surgery, just the lumpectomy, all of the treatment. And all the way through my journey, people kept saying to me, do you have a family history of cancer? You know, you're very young. It's really rare to get breast cancer under 30. And I said, no, I don't. And I still don't to this day have a family history of breast or ovarian cancer. And this was a long time ago. So we're talking about 17 years ago. It might even be the 18 years now. And they didn't give me genetic testing. Now, if my cancer had happened today, the type of cancer I had is called triple negative. It is quite common with people that have hereditary mutations, but also my age. They're two real sort of red flags that you've probably got some kind of hereditary thing going on. So after I finished all my treatment, I think it would have been 3 weeks after I finished radiation, I found out I was pregnant. So
naturally or through IVF?
Naturally.
Naturally. God, golly. Wow. The universe works in mysterious ways.
Yeah, just bizarre. And, you know, I remember actually because my oncologist had said to me, please don't get pregnant for at least 2 years. You know, you've had a very aggressive type of cancer. We don't want to be treating you pregnant or with a young baby. Like your chance of recurrence is very high. So when I found out I was pregnant, my first thought was, well, you lied. You told me my fertility would be affected. But my second thought was, oh, I've got to tell my oncologist. I honestly felt like a teenager telling their dad they were pregnant. Like I kind of was sheepishly walked into his office and I was like, well, I'm pregnant. And he was just like, well, you know, it is what it is. And, you know, he said, look, it'll be fine. You know, we'll just kind of work through it. And, you know, I'm incredibly fortunate. I didn't get a recurrence and you know, I had this beautiful baby. And when she was about 6 months old, I just wasn't comfortable with getting breast cancer so young. So I did my own research, Googling, and I started to read about hereditary mutations with people that have Ashkenazi Jewish ancestry. And that basically is just Jewish people from Eastern Europe. Now, my dad and his family are Jewish from Lithuania.
Wow.
And I was like, oh, hold on a minute. And I'm disappointed again that when people were asking about my family history, they weren't asking about the Jewish ancestry too, because I probably would have got genetic testing then. But, you know, to give you some kind of idea of how prevalent it is in this community, 1 in 400 people roughly have a genetic mutation that causes cancer. In Ashkenazi Jewish people, it's 1 in 40. So they have such a high chance of having some kind of hereditary mutation. And not just they, those communities have a lot of illnesses that are, you know, hereditary. So I called
up. Is there any reason for that, or is it just luck of the draw, or is just the, I mean, by luck of the draw, I mean the kind of the hereditary luck of the draw, the gene mutation, is that, or because it's such a close-knit community, why is it so prevalent in that particular space?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I think it's really due to often with things that are hereditary, you can sort of like breed them out for, you know, for want of a better expression. But in Jewish communities, they tend to kind of marry Jewish people. And I think that sometimes can exacerbate those sort of hereditary issues in families. So, yeah, it's an interesting one that I've learned a lot about along the way.
I could imagine. And through your diagnosis as well, I understand you discovered that you have the BRCA1 gene mutation. What does that mean for those that are listening? Because it is, I think when you've had cancer, you understand all the acronyms. For those that have never been through the journey, you know, what does that particular mutation mean, and how does that sort of, what does that mean to your cancer journey?
Yeah, so BRCA actually just stands for breast cancer. And basically we all have BRCA or BRCA1 genes in our bodies. But what's the problem with mine is it's faulty. It doesn't work. And its actual job is to protect you against cancer. So, and the one I inherited from my dad is broken basically, or, you know, it's not working the way it should. Therefore, it's not protecting me against getting cancer the way it should. So, you know, that's kind of really, it's actually sort of quite simple when you explain it like that. So, you know, people often say I have the BRCA1 gene, but we all have the BRCA1 genes. It's just that mine's a mutation. And actually we're moving away from calling them mutations because I think it has a bit of a negative connotation, but it's a variation. It doesn't work the way it should.
Well, it's interesting because I'm obviously just recently found out, found out I was pregnant. And, you know, my other two children are in the last, my son's 10 years old. So I've had quite a lot of time in between pregnancies. But I really noticed this time around there was significantly more testing available, probably because of my age as well. But also one of the things they offered up was a very expensive, also I might add, gene testing where you get 400 genes tested or something. And they literally could have this whole list of, you know, things they test for, hereditary mutations or variations, as you call them, or what have you, to kind of pick up if there's anything that you might be concerned about, which I thought was fascinating, which obviously must be a relatively newer type test that you can take, but would have in that test presumably have told, well, would have told had I'd had any of these, you know, variations as well. turns out I found out I had the cystic fibrosis recessive gene, which I thought was fascinating, but nothing else. But does that, I mean, is that something that was offered to you when you were having your children? And is it valuable, I suppose, to mums? Is that worthwhile having? I mean, particularly as we talk about hereditary diseases like breast cancer.
So the panel you would have been offered wouldn't check for BRCA. So that's kind of, it would be more the things that would affect your baby. Of course, BRCA does, but see, it's interesting. BRCA testing and hereditary cancer testing isn't usually done until you're at least 18. So my children won't be tested until they're 18 because it's not an early onset disease. You know, people are not getting breast and ovarian cancer before they're 18. And having that knowledge is actually, you know, when I think about my that beautiful little baby is now a delightful almost 16-year-old teenager. And, you know, when I think about her and having that knowledge even now, it would be way too much to sort of carry. So, yeah, look, and sorry, back to your question around, you know, how much things, you know, have changed, right? And we are literally in a genomics revolution. We are learning so much more about disease and, you know, using genomics to understand more about diseases, not just cancer, but many, many illnesses. And, you know, I think it's fantastic. There's just so much knowledge out there to help us, you know, lead really healthy lives. And, you know, unfortunately, when you have a BRCA mutation, you can't 100% prevent your cancer, but you can reduce your risk a lot. So, you know, as far as we're concerned, knowledge is power, and I think it's fantastic.
And is it true that the, you know, the mutation, if you do have a mutation, you're, like in your case, more likely to get breast cancer? If you get breast cancer under 50, it's more likely to be a mutation, and over 50, it's likely to be just kind of older age and environmental factors and lifestyle and things. Is that kind of idea hold any truth? I've just heard that before. I've always wondered if it was a fair representation.
Yeah. Look, generally speaking, that's true. People with hereditary mutations do often get cancer at a younger age. And yes, generally speaking, I mean, you know, two biggest risk factors for breast cancer are being female, which we can't change, and our age, which we can't change, right? So as you get older, you know, your risk definitely increases. We tend to find younger people often get what I had, triple negative type cancers, whereas older people get those more hormonal type cancers. Mm-hmm. And again, I use lots of words that, you know, I'm familiar with, but triple negative just means, so when you get breast cancer, they look at three receptors on your tumor, an estrogen receptor, progesterone receptor, and a protein called HER2. And those three receptors, I had none of them on my cancer. So that they call that triple negative. But then you might have a hormone type cancer. You might have an estrogen or a progesterone. So I'm struggling to get those words out today. And they're called sort of a hormonal type cancer. And then the HER protein, that one's really important because there's some really good drugs out there to kind of take after your cancer. There's one called Herceptin, which and you know, there's others, but they help to prevent the cancer coming back. The same with the hormonal ones. So you'll often hear about people that once their cancer finishes, they'll go on to a longer term drug to kind of really stop the cancer, kind of blocks all the hormones in their body. And the issue with triple negative is we don't have those drugs, right? There's newer ones. Actually, this year I'm seeing a lot trying to get through PBAC at the moment, which is the Pharmaceutical Benefits Advisory Committee. So we have to get it through that in Australia to get it listed on, you know, on Medicare, so that it's you know, funded rather than unfunded. But yeah, so basically that's kind of the difference. But you know, I am talking very generally. There will be older people that will get breast cancer that have a hereditary mutation, and younger people that will get hormonal cancers. But yes. Generally speaking.
Yes, well, I know Herceptin very well. In fact, in a previous life when I used to do work in pharmaceuticals and healthcare, we actually brought Herceptin to the market here in Australia and worked through obviously the, you know, TGAC and the PBAC and getting it to market and stuff like that. But it was definitely one of those life-changing moments when you met all these very brave women, you know, that had experienced this really aggressive cancer, and this drug, you know, really provided a, you know, a light, you know, for them to lead a normal life with their family and children. And I suppose that brings me to my question in terms of your journey. I mean, you're a mum of young, you found out you're pregnant, but you're a mum of technically two young children still. I mean, it must have been incredibly difficult to learn that this was hereditary and could be passed down to your daughter, who you said was 16. I mean, how do you, as a mum, how do you deal with that?
Yeah, it's really tough. You know, we talk a lot about, you know, all the things you want to pass on to your children. It's not hereditary cancer. Like, you know, it is tough. And, you know, of course, it's not my fault. And it just is what it is. For me, my daughter's always been very aware of what's happening, you know, this mutation that's in our family. Because even before I was CEO of Pink Hope, I did a lot of fundraising. So I was very involved with the charity, and I actually organised a fun run for 6 years in Melbourne and raised about $100,000 over those 6 years. And my daughter was very involved in that. So she's always been very aware. It's funny, she'll go through phases where she'll talk to me about it a lot and ask me, and, you know, what does it mean and what will happen if I do have it as well. She hasn't spoken to me about it for a while, and, you know, I leave it there. As she gets closer to 18, we'll start having those conversations again. My feeling is I don't want her to get tested at 18. I still think that's too young to have that kind of information. I'd like her to be probably a little bit closer to 20. The issue we have is me being so young when you're diagnosed, they often talk about 10 years below your youngest relative. So for her, that's sort of 19.
Right. Okay.
I still think, you know, she's probably got it. There's a bit of time, you know, leeway around that. But we will have to start thinking about it. But, you know, it's 50-50. She may test negative and it will literally be like winning the lottery. So we'll just wait and see.
And what are the options? I mean, you obviously go and she gets the testing, you know, if she is a carrier, what does your organisation or healthcare professionals recommend for somebody like your daughter in this position?
So initially they would talk about high-risk screening. So she would be eligible to have annual MRIs, which is great. You know, it's the gold standard. Because, you know, something that's really important to consider for younger women is breast density. And it's something that we're talking a lot about now. I'm seeing a lot of talk about it in Australia, how it's really important for people to understand. But generally speaking, the younger you are, you have very dense breasts. Mammograms just won't pick up cancers. So I shouldn't say they won't. They sometimes miss them if you've got really dense breasts. So the fact that she can have annual MRIs is fantastic. So that would be the initial plan for her, is to get her on a high-risk screening program. That won't prevent her getting cancer, but it will at least pick it up very, very early. Longer term, this will have to be completely her choice, but really the only way to reduce your risk as much as possible is to have a mastectomy, mm-hmm. Which, you know, is quite overwhelming to think about when you think about your children. So it will just be a wait and see, I guess, and what she chooses to do. What we often find is some people find that high-risk screening really challenging. It's that scanxiety that, you know, what leading up to it, waiting for the results. And often people just say, I don't want to live like this. I feel like I'm just waiting to get cancer. A BRCA1 mutation gives you around a 70 to 80% lifetime risk of getting breast cancer.
Wow.
It's almost it's really high. You know, it's not if, it's almost like a when. And me being so young is also often when they're looking at risk in families, they'll look at other family members. Unfortunately for us, I don't have anyone else. But, you know, when you're looking at me being so young, but, you know, there are other things you can do to try and reduce your risk. Obviously, when you're genetically predisposed, it's very hard. But, you know, staying healthy, all those usual things, don't smoke, reduce your alcohol intake, stay fit, you know, stay active, try not to, think about your weight. Those kind of things, you know, are in your control. I guess it'll just be a play it by ear, I guess, yeah.
And I suppose, I mean, we know that breast cancer now is one of the most prevalent cancers in the world that affects women and indeed some men, I understand. But I also know ovarian cancer is also one of those, cancers that are rapidly affecting a lot of women. You know, I presume, are the risk factors similar Is that hereditary variation as prevalent? And again, you know, what is the advice to anybody that's you know, that might have that, you know, predisposition for ovarian cancer?
Yeah, so ovarian cancer is just an awful cancer. So my risk, so BRCA gives you a very high risk of both breast and ovarian. Ovarian's slightly lower, so my risk of ovarian was somewhere between 40% to 60%. And also they know with ovarian cancer with BRCA women that it doesn't generally sort of, your risk doesn't really start to increase until you're around 40. So it does give you the opportunity to have your children before you have to sort of think about any decisions. Now, there is no reliable screening for ovarian cancer. So, you know, people, you can have ultrasounds and people talk about blood tests, but the reality is that they're not reliable. And so the only way you can reduce your risk as much as possible is to remove your ovaries and your fallopian tubes. And they say remove your fallopian tubes because they believe that the cancer often starts in the fallopian tubes but moves very quickly to the ovaries because of the way tubes, you know, sweep across the ovaries. Mm. And there's a lot of research being done in that at the moment, which is fantastic because they're hoping to get to a point where maybe with BRCA women you just have to remove your tubes, not your ovaries. Because as someone that removed my ovaries at 38, going through surgical menopause at a young age is really tough. And it also in some ways can have, I mean, look, cancer's terrible, but surgical menopause is not good for you either, because when you go through natural menopause, you have a sort of, you know, a natural kind of slow decline of estrogen over a number of years. When you go through surgical menopause, it's just like, bang, your body's just lost all of this estrogen. And, you know, you have to think about osteoporosis, cardiovascular disease, early onset dementia, you know. So there's all these other things, you know, you're sort of trading off. And so I'm lucky in because I had triple negative breast cancer, we know my cancer wasn't using hormones to grow. So I can take hormone replacement therapy. So that, you know, it's not the same as what your body can produce, but it's better than nothing. I think my endocrinologist, my hormone doctor, described it like an amazing orchestra, and you take out this incredible player and then you replace him with someone that's not very good. So, you know, it'll keep going, but it's not quite the same. So yeah, it's a good analogy.
Because, I mean, we have a lot of mums at Little Oak that obviously are going, sadly, or, you know, have they're experienced, you know, cancer in the breast or invariably a lot of ovarian cancer as well, you know, that they, you know, a lot of their doctors have said, you know, don't go through with the, obviously, hormone kind of induced cancer, don't go through with the pregnancy because it will, you know, accelerate the growth of the tumour, which I just can't imagine, you know, the anguish that these mums go through, you know, the ones that are brave enough to continue to go through the treatment, you know, while trying to nurse a child, you know, through to birth. I mean, do you see a number of those stories, or have you heard many of those stories? And what are they like? I can't even imagine how tough that must be.
Yeah, it's funny because we were having a conversation about this the other day. You know, it does pregnancy bring on breast cancer? You know, there's a lot of debate. You know, generally speaking, the evidence says no. I think particularly in our community, right, because our community is people that have hereditary mutations, if they're going to get cancer, it generally tends to be younger, you know, when they are having children, right? So I think that's probably more the correlation. But yes, we definitely have seen women that, you know, find out when they're pregnant or they've, you know, just had a baby. We actually just did a documentary series on three women with triple negative breast cancer because we're really focusing on that because it's a very aggressive cancer. And one of the beautiful women has six children. She was pregnant with her fifth and found a lump, but, you know, fobbed off. This is the problem, I think, when you're pregnant, that often doctors will go, oh, you know, it's this, it's that, it's the pregnancy, or you're breastfeeding, it's milk ducts, blocked milk ducts, all of that. But by the time they finally worked out, it was breast cancer. Then she kind of went through all of her treatment and they told her she was all clear. And she said, look, I want to have another baby. I feel like I really missed out with, you know, this baby. I didn't, you know, I was going through my cancer. And they said, yep, it's fine. And then when she was pregnant, I think, or the baby was just born, they found out it metastasized. It's just, I get goosebumps thinking that she's such a beautiful woman and these six beautiful children. And it just, yeah, it's so, it's really tough for these women because they're young, you know, yeah. And that's what we were trying to highlight this documentary. Cancer isn't, breast cancer isn't necessarily an older women's disease. We see women that are, you know, they're looking after children, they're working, they're carers, they're, you know, it's a really, and it's tough to get cancer at any stage in your life, but these women are really trying to, you know, live and they have a lot of responsibilities. It's hard.
Huge, huge. And so on that note then, just in terms of, you know, for all the women out there, you know, what should we be out on the lookout for in terms of, you know, breast cancer and ovarian cancer? I mean, we hear all the obvious ones like check your breasts regularly, but, you know, presumably there's other things that, you know, perhaps more subtle things that you're not kind of quite aware of unless you've been through it. You know, can you share some of those perhaps more subtle symptoms?
So, you know, going back to myself and, you know, admitting that I wasn't checking my breasts at 29, we, for Breast Cancer Awareness Month, we've launched Know Your Normal, which is a campaign around, like, literally that, let's get to know what our normal is, because that's, I think we've overcomplicated breast checking, right? It doesn't need to be complicated. Feel and touch your body and look at it enough so that you know what's normal, because you're looking for something that wasn't there a week ago. So you're like, oh, that's a little bit different. I'll monitor it for a week. Still there? Go and see your doctor. Like, that's really the message we're trying to get out. We also set up a breast check reminder, which I'd love if you could share. But
absolutely,
it's a sign up. It's completely free, and you get an SMS and an email every 6 weeks, and it just, you know, the SMS is purely just a time to check your breasts, and the emails have got a little bit more information, just trying to help people get into a regular routine. But really, if we start that routine in our 20s, when you're very unlikely to have breast cancer, it's about putting that routine in place. And, you know, by the time you're in your 30s, 40s and older, it's just, yep, that's just something I do. But we did a couple of surveys, one last year and this year. One of the things we did this year is we asked about, you know, what are the signs and symptoms. And a lot of people didn't know that some of the symptoms, such as, you know, redness, feeling warm, you know, we're all thinking about a lump, but it might be discharge from my nipple. My nipple's inverted. I've got some puckering, some, you know, the skin feels a bit rashy, different, you know, anything. You're looking for any kind of change. It's not always going to be an obvious lump. So I think that's the key. If it wasn't there a week ago, still there in a week, go and see your doctor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Ovarian cancer, though, sorry, if I can, is really, really tough because the symptoms are quite generic. However, it's the same thing, you know, trust our gut. Women have amazing instincts. Don't be fobbed off. If you see a GP and he's not listening to you, find another one. It's okay to get a second opinion. And, yeah, look, you know, it is, unfortunately, it's a lot of those symptoms that come with you, you know, with your menstrual cycle and that kind of thing. But it's the same principle. It wasn't there a week ago. Oh, it's you know, still here in a week or two. Go and talk to a doctor.
Yeah, I think you're right about the second opinion. My mum's best friend started the Breast Cancer Foundation of WA years ago, still running to this day. But she always said the number of people that had their cancer had been undiagnosed or incorrectly diagnosed, you know, and then lost their lives as a result of that was because they didn't go and get a second opinion. So I remember much, you know, many years ago, she, you know, when I was a little bit concerned about something, it turned out to be nothing. But she said, you get a second opinion, you get a third opinion, you get a, you get enough to feel comfortable that you've got the right thing. And she said, it doesn't matter if you require how many extra checks, she said, at least you're getting a proper, you'll get an accurate diagnosis, which I thought was great advice. It was the one thing she said to all women, but another good thing to remember. But tell me now, Sarah, I mean, obviously you're at Pink Hope, a fabulous organization, you know, and there's all these wonderful things like your genetic counseling and things, but perhaps you can just help us understand, you know, what does Pink Hope stand for? What are you hoping to achieve? And, you know, when should people get in contact with you?
Yeah, so we're Australia's only charity that supports families with hereditary cancer. And, you know, we really talk about, we want to break the cycle of cancer in families and just help people to understand and reduce their risk of cancer. So we work in three main areas: support, education, and advocacy. Our support is online. So we have private online support groups, have about 2,200 women in those. Great way to kind of provide that peer support for women and, you know, women that really get it. I often talk about with my journey, Sorry, I don't know, a lot of people with cancer don't like the word journey, but, you know, it, with my journey, I had cancer and then I found out I had a hereditary, you know, mutation. And I found the hereditary mutation part for me personally really hard to deal with because it didn't end with me anymore. You know, my cancer ended with me. Hereditary cancer just doesn't end. It, you know, it's this constant cycle. And also the decision-making, it's the thing that most women and you know, people that come to us say, it's, you know, oh, so I've got to have surgery or do I not have surgery? Do I keep going with screening and when do I do it? You know, and it's all of this. When do I talk to my children? And so, you know, that online support, but we also do face-to-face support groups as well in different parts of Australia. Our education is our, you know, our website is our, you know, it's got so much information in lots of different ways, podcasts, webinars, blogs, personal stories, you know, all evidence-based information. And then we have our social media channels where we really, we have about over 60,000 people follow us across our channels. And we use that to really kind of get those messages out there and help educate and empower. We're very much about empowerment, you know. You know, when you were talking before about second opinions, I often say to people, if you were buying a car, you would definitely go and see more than one, right? But when it comes to our health, we go to one doctor and we trust that opinion. And not to say I'm not doctor bashing by any means, but, you know, if you don't feel right and you don't feel you're being listened to, it's okay to go and talk to someone else and get a second opinion. So that's, you know, we on our website, we even have checklists like you're going to go and see your genetic counselor. Here's some questions you might want to ask just to kind of really help people and prompt those conversations.
Yeah.
You know, patients need to, we should be an equal partner in our healthcare journey. And, you know, and I think there's a real shift happening in that. But yeah, we want to help people. And advocacy is the biggest, one of the biggest things we do in terms of, and probably the thing that doesn't get seen as much, but, you know, supporting PBAC submissions so that these, you know, medications get to patients quicker. You know, we were in Parliament House this year talking to MPs about the wait lists for surgery, which are huge in Australia. You know, we know that there are women that are getting breast cancer while they're waiting to have surgery to reduce their risk of breast cancer because it's classed as category three. It's like elective surgery. You know, it's basically the same as a tonsillectomy and it's, you know,
crazy.
So those kind of things that we're really advocating to the government for change. And look, I suppose I took over as CEO 3 years ago. I was a big part of the community, like I said, and our founder wanted to step down and do some different things. And I was put forward for the role. I'm incredibly fortunate to get it because it is honestly the best job I've ever had in the world. I absolutely love it. Because, you know, I live and breathe this. This is my life. You know, I've got my own daughter and it obviously gives me that drive and passion to make the future different for families like mine and our children and our relatives. So, yeah.
It's fantastic. And I suppose as we kind of, I mean, there's so many standout and memorable, you know, moments, I'm sure, that go well beyond what you've just talked about. But, you know, as we wrap up today's conversation, Sarah, you know, what's the one piece of advice you'd offer to women during Breast Cancer Awareness Month?
Check your breasts and get yourself into a regular routine. And don't be scared. Don't think, I don't know what to do. And, you know, it's so incredibly important. Breast cancer has great survival rates. We're around about 90% in Australia, which is fantastic. But that is if you find your cancer early. The earlier you find your cancer, the less treatment you'll need. And generally, you'll have a better prognosis. And so just get into that routine and also mix it up. So, you know, we used to talk about this first of the month, but the risk there is if you've got a regular menstrual cycle, you're just doing it at the same point in your cycle. So that's why we went with every 6 weeks with our reminders. So mix it up, lay down, stand up in the shower, different lights, you know, it's just about doing it in different places, but also just getting comfortable feeling your body. You know, it's, and I think that's something that sometimes we can feel a little bit uncomfortable with. But, you know, and it's not just your breasts, right? It's a holistic view. Know your body well and you look for any changes and be comfortable to go and talk to your doctor.
Fantastic. So, Sarah, looking ahead, what's next for you and Pink Hope?
Well, tomorrow I get on a plane to Madrid. I'm presenting at a conference in Madrid. I have so much to do. You should see my house. But I am fortunate enough that I was the lead author on a paper, a patient-authored manuscript around basically our goal is to advocate to governments to improve the criteria for genetic testing because it is quite strict in Australia to get Medicare-funded genetic testing. We want all women who have breast cancer to be offered genetic testing. So I'm presenting the abstracts of my paper at ESMO, which is the European Society of Medical Oncology, and huge conference. So that's my next step.
Very good.
Tomorrow and all weekends. But look, we, for us, we really want to cement our place. Like, we've always been about hereditary cancer. So we're spending a lot of time with primary care. So, you know, GPs, practice nurses, we know, that they're the first person you will go to if you've got a concern. We want to make sure they're educated and understand. You know, we have too many women that come to us and say, my GP said I was too young to get cancer. And you're like, so, you know, we, there's a lot of work to be done around that. And really another big thing for us is becoming much more inclusive. So we're doing focus groups around some sort of underrepresented communities, I guess, sort of LGBTQI, rural, regional, culturally and linguistically diverse, First Nations. So, you know, a lot of communities that often don't get represented as well. So, you know, we're trying to find out, well, what are their needs and are we supporting them the best way we can, and what needs to change, you know, in our healthcare system to support them better.
It's amazing. Fantastic stuff. Well, Sarah, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing the Pink Hope journey and milestones and fabulous work that you're doing. Tell me, how can our listeners get in touch and stay connected with you?
So head to our website, pinkhope.org.au. And look, if anyone has any questions, you know, we are small enough that I talk to people on the phone all the time. I take emails, you know, if anyone wants to, we have a phone number on our website. We've got our email address. Just get in contact, you know, have a think about your family history. We say to people, start that conversation in your family. You know, do you have cancer in your family? If you think you do, come to us, have a chat. We can sort of point you in the right direction and support you.
Fantastic. Well, Sarah, thank you so much. And thank you to everyone listening today to this little episode of This Little Life. And we hope you found this discussion as valuable and as enjoyable as I did. And if you'd like to stay in touch on all our latest episodes and receive notifications about future releases, please make sure you subscribe to our podcast on your favorite platform, whether that's Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And don't forget to leave us a review and share this podcast with your loved ones. Your feedback and support mean the absolute world to us. And as always, if you have any suggestions for future topics or guests, feel free to reach out to us on our socials. We'd love to hear from you. So until next time, everyone, take care and please make sure that you take some time to enjoy this little life.